This is Audible.
Ravenna Rogue. Written by Dan Abnett. Read by Toby Longwell. To have faith is to have purpose, and purpose in life is what defines a man, and makes him steadfast and resolute. Faith keeps him true, and, even in the darkest hours, illuminates him like a candle flame. Faith guides him surely from birth to the grave. It shows him the path, and prevents him from straying into the lightless thickets where insanity awaits. To lose faith is to lose purpose, and to be bereft of guidance. For a man without faith will no longer be true, and a mind without purpose will walk in dark places. The Spheres of Longing, 2-9-31. Keep your friends close, and your enemies closer. Ancient human adage. Then, Sleef Outworld, 336.M41. It was all over. Audion's scheme was in tatters. All that mattered now was survival.
"Don't make me kill you,"
the bounty hunter ordered. He was standing 10 meters away and had a gun aimed at Zygmunt Moloch's face. The bounty hunter was formidably large and shaven-headed. His powerful body was packed into a matte black body glove. He had been sent to watch the back steps into the upper vents.
"Oh, please don't,"
Moloch cried, and sank to his knees in the sulphurous dust. Loki, he decided, instantly. That was the man's accent. Loki, the Freeze World. That meant tough, no quarter, best of the best. No surprise that their opponent would employ the best of the best. Keeping the big handgun aimed at Moloch's head, the bounty hunter came forward. Moloch could hear his approaching footsteps crunching the sand. "That's it. Close the distance. 10 meters is no use to me. Arm's length will make us equal, gun or no gun."
"Identify yourself,"
the bounty hunter commanded.
"My name is Satis,"
Moloch replied. He dropped his voice a tone and a half and affected the nasal twang of South Shore Sameter.
"I'm a flyer, just a flyer, sir,"
he whimpered slightly for effect, trusting that the Flyer's Guild jacket he had dragged off a corpse 5 minutes earlier would back up his story.
"Are you armed?"
"No, sir. Indeed, I am not."
The edge of the bounty hunter's shadow fell across him, cast by the lurid flames spewing up out of the vents. "One step closer. Just another step."
"Nail,"
a voice called out, a woman's voice, thickly accented. Moloch tensed. Peering up, he saw a second person approaching. Saw her feet, anyway. Leather armor, tight lashed. A particular loop-in-loop detailing to the hidework decoration. That and the accent added together to make a Carthayan swordswoman. Best of the best, once again.
"Just kill him," said the woman.
"Wait,"
replied the bounty hunter. Moloch heard him adjust his voxlink.
"Iron wishes thorn, by heartbeat, dark after dusk. Petals scattered, abundant. Teal sky, closed shells, whispering dogs adjacent. Patton Delta?"
"Query adjacent dogs. The center of the ripple. Spreading."
"A thaw. Idiot mouths,"
the bounty hunter replied.
"Patton Delta?"
he asked again.
"Patton denied. Patton Silver."
Some informal code. It was fascinating to hear. Moloch divined the principles quickly. He'd always had a talent for languages. His opponent was instructing the bounty hunter to keep Moloch alive, pending interview. The bounty hunter, Nail, it seemed his name was leaning towards Moloch's claim to be just a hapless accomplice to the day's events.
"Patton confirmed."
"Look at me,"
the woman said. Moloch eagerly wanted to, but he was in character, and his character was timid and scared. He kept his head bowed and mewed a sob. The bounty hunter hoisted Moloch back onto his feet. His grip was astonishingly strong. Moloch found himself facing the bounty hunter, Nail, and the swordswoman. She was typical of her breed, taller than most grown men, almost Astarte's height, but slender. Her hair tight braided, her body cased in leather armor, a tasseled cloak flapping out like wings in the wind. Every centimeter of her tight armor and her cloak was ritually decorated with scrollwork, knotting, and bronze studs. She was the most beautiful thing Moloch had ever seen, and he instantly decided he had to kill her. She had a sword in her hands, clenched firmly as if it was feather light and about to fly away on the mountain wind. It was a saber of extraordinary length, two-thirds as tall as she was. The blue cast of the metal told Moloch it had been folded 18 or 19 times, which was typical of ancient Carthaean metalwork, and indicated it was a masterpiece weapon, a priceless antique, and, very likely, a psychic blade. The oldest Carthaean steels all were. That meant the woman and the sword were united in sentience. Yes, he could see it quiver ever so slightly in time with her breathing. "You are a flyer?" she asked, staring down at him. Moloch made sure the fear remained in his eyes, even though all that was really there was desire. He was captivated. She was extraordinary, a goddess. He wanted to possess her. He wanted to hear her cry out his name in that delicious outworld accent as she died.
"I am a flyer, indeed," he replied.
Tone and accent, tone and accent. "You were hired?"
"Just for conveyance. It was a legal contract of hire."
"Leave him alone," the bounty hunter said. "There'll be time for that later."
He was studying the vents above them, watching the glow of the plasma fires light up the sky. The woman's brow furrowed.
"Barbariseta thirsts," she said. "He is not what he seems."
She was good. She'd seen something, or the sword had smelled something. He longed to know what it was, so he could correct it next time. Accent? Body language? It wasn't the time to ask. The bounty hunter was turning back to face him. Moloch knew he was about to be afforded a 1 or possibly 2 second window of opportunity, and that was all, and if he missed it, he would be dead. He had to swerve the initiative quickly.
"Who are you?"
he asked suddenly. The bounty hunter blinked in surprise.
"I need to know who you are,"
Moloch said, more urgently.
"Shut it,"
Nail said.
"I just don't know what's going on,"
Moloch whined.
"Better you don't,"
Nail replied, and glanced at the woman.
"Cover him while I search him for weapons, Arianod."
Arianod. Nail. Now he had both their names. The woman nodded and swept the sword around in a high guard that Moloch was fairly sure was called the En-Kulsar. She held it there. Over her shoulder, the vents boomed again. Nail reached forward. When he'd been down on his knees, Moloch had picked one of the heavy brass buttons off the cuff of the flyer's coat and palmed it. He fired it with a flick of his index finger up into Nail's left eye. Nail cursed and jerked backwards. Moloch sprang past him, hooking his toe behind the bounty hunter's calf to turn the stagger into an outright fall. The woman was already moving, the saber lunging.
"Arianod,"
Moloch said, using the tone of command. She hesitated. A hesitation was all he was ever going to get out of a Carthaean swordswoman, especially as he didn't know her full clan name. But it was enough. A momentary wrong foot. He chopped the edge of his hand into her neck between the lip of her armor's collar and her braided hair. The muscles in her left shoulder went into involuntary spasm. As she recoiled in surprise, he lifted the saber out of her hands. It was like taking hold of the choke chain of an attack dog. The saber fought him. It didn't want his touch. It pulled like the reins of a bolting steed. Moloch knew he had absolutely no hope of mastering it. Instead, he let it pull away from him like a kite in a gale. Straight into the bounty hunter. Nail had just recovered from his stumble and was pouncing to snap Moloch's neck. The Carthaean saber impaled itself through his belly before he even saw it. The bounty hunter made a soft sound like a tut of disappointment. There was surprisingly little blood, even when he slid off the blade. It was so sharp that the lips of the wounds it had cut through flesh and body glove closed tight again, sealed along perfect incisions. Nail hit the dust and lay there, one knee bent, his back arched. Moloch let go of the saber and set it free. It flew away as if he'd thrown it.
He didn't bother to see where it fell. The woman was a more pressing concern. She uttered no words or curses as she came at him, which seemed remarkably restrained. Moloch wondered just how many tenets of the Ula Waila Skrayi he had just dishonored by taking her blade from her and using it on her comrade. A sevenfold shame, he estimated. He'd spare her the drudge of penance and mortification by killing her. Someone had trained her well. He barely avoided a two-fingered jab that came at him like the blade of a chisel, and deflected the iron-hard edge of her other hand with a brush of his forearm. She pivoted and swept around with her left leg, so long and shapely, and he had to swing out with his hips, arms raised like a dancer, in order to miss it. Her weight came over onto her left leg as it landed, and she swung the right leg out after it, backwards, wheeling herself into the air. This time, the flying right toe cap almost connected. Moloch flopped right back at the waist, dropping his chin into his collarbone to minimize the profile of his face, and converted his body's downward progress into a spring of his right hand that flipped him behind her as she landed. Aware of him, she back-jabbed with her right elbow to crack his jaw. He stopped her elbow with the cup of his right hand, an impact hard enough to sting his palm, and drove his left fist in under her armpit with the middle finger extended like a beak. She yowled and lurched away. He'd been studying her intricate body armor, the patterns of bronze studs, the leather ridges, the knotwork. All designed to deflect a blade. Simple, very effective. When you fought a sword, the last thing you wanted to take was a scratch that would bleed you to weakness or death. All but the truest killing thrusts could be turned by her armor's complex surface. But a fist wasn't a blade edge. A hand wasn't a sword. A cluster of bronze studs, placed perfectly to glance away a cut to the ribs, simply provided a target for a beaked fist. They as good as marked out the mid-axillary line, and that governed the autonomic supply to the heart. She tried to turn, but she was hurt, and, besides, he was enjoying himself too much. He kicked her in the back of the left knee and met her falling body with the heel of his left hand, striking the sacral plexus and flaring pain through her pelvis and legs. She screamed. She was strong, three or four times as strong as him. She tore away and tried to roll clear. Having exploited the disadvantages of her armor, Moloch turned his attention to her cloak. Who but a barbarian fought at a cloak? He grabbed it and pulled it with both arms as he simultaneously raised his left leg in a sidekick. Arianod snapped backwards, throttled by her cloak clasp, and the back of her head slammed into his kicking foot. She was done. The urge to linger and kill her was immense, but there was no time to relish it, no time to explore a truly complex death. Pleasure could wait. All that mattered was survival. Moloch started up the rock-cut stairs into the cliff. The smell of the vents was pungent. Clouds of miasmal gas fogged the air. It was hot. He began to move more quickly and took off the borrowed jacket, throwing it aside. He was already making mental notes and annotations. The cognitae trained a man to recognize defeat or failure the moment it happened, and to be empowered by that knowledge. Men are often crippled or undone by the prospect of defeat, and that makes them vulnerable. A cognitae was never vulnerable unless he chose to make himself so. A defeat was something to be identified, analyzed, and used. A defeat was a springboard to launch a man onwards. That was what Madame Chase had taught them. Schemes failed. Plans came apart. Nothing happened with dead certainty. But men only perished when they allowed themselves the weakness of disappointment or maudlin regret. A waste of effort, when the effort expended on regret could be put to much better use. Clinical, precise, his mind calculated. Next time he would plan scrupulously, because next time he would be in charge. Audion had been a flawed choice as leader. Moloch had only gone along with it because there was a matter of seniority to be respected. Audion was 12 years his senior, Moloch a new, unproven graduate. No matter his extraordinary achievements as a student. Extraordinary even in a school of extraordinarily able souls. Moloch was still obliged to wait his turn. He fancied Chase had appointed him to Audion's team to keep an eye on the venture. In which case, he had failed. The plan was ruined, and Audion was dead. The others, too, as far as Moloch knew. He should have acted the moment Ordean started to lose perspective. Those little decisions, for instance, early on, that Moloch had disagreed with. He should have acted. He should have taken the initiative and confronted Ordean. If necessary, he should have killed Ordean and replaced him. These things he was now learning. Do not rely on a leader. Be your own leader. And, as leader, do not rely on your subordinates to check your actions, for they may well be guilty of the first sin. Next time, these things would be corrected. All that remained to do was to make sure there was a next time. He reached the upper levels of the crags. The limestone cliffs curved away beneath him like old yellow bone. Far below, in the gnarled landscape of the lower vents, he could see the smudgy outline of their base camp. The Gnosis engines were down there still, unless the Inquisitors had smashed them. So tantalizingly within reach, so precious, even though they had barely half-loaded them to capacity. The vents had spoken much more slowly than Ordean had predicted. 2 weeks, Ordean had estimated, followed by a return trip to Sarum with at least two, if not three, engines ripe and ready for use. But they had been on Sleaf 3 months, more than enough time for the agencies of the throne to track them, corner them, and bring them down. The pale blue air shimmered with heat haze. The vents erupted periodically, boiling vast tides of superhot plasmatic flow up from the planet's ugly heart. They'd timed their visit to coincide with an eruptive period. The voices were said to be louder and more talkative at such times. Now it seemed as if the plasma vents were booming and lighting up the sky in sympathy with the afternoon's violence. Yellow smoke trickled back across the clifftop. Rock waste from the large surge pattered off the crags and skittered down the steeper drops. He could taste the hot stench in his mouth. He paused by a large, ovoid boulder and took his link out of his pocket.
"Are you still there?"
he asked.
"Who is this? Ordean?"
"It's Moloch. Everyone's dead. It's time to leave October Country, before they find you in parking orbit."
"We appreciate the tip."
"Don't think you're going without me," Moloch said.
"Of course."
A pause.
"We'll do our best. Are you near transport?"
"No. Fire up the teleport and lock onto my signal."
"The teleport's too valuable to risk."
"I'm too valuable to leave here, you bastards. Fire it up."
"Moloch, I'm telling you, the vents are in flare. That activity is going to play hell with the teleport. Maybe even fry it. And that's if we get a fix."
"That's why I headed for high ground, to make it easy for you. I'm right up on the cliffs. Lock onto my signal."
"Move around. Into the open. Hurry!"
Moloch moved out from beside the rock. Plasma heat and the sunlight stung his face. The wind caught his hair. Holding the link out, he clambered up the rocks until he was overlooking two of the main vents. He walked to the edge of one. Plasma bloomed in bright clouds from the crags a couple of kilometers west. It would be another 5 minutes until a surge came here again. He looked down. The drop was immense. The terror was stimulating. Such a long way down, a long drop, it seemed, into the bowels of hell. The vent was 40 meters in diameter, its walls scorched black and smoking, and it fell away for thousands of meters, straight down. Far below, there was a glimmer of light as the flames began to rise again.
"Hurry up,"
Moloch said.
"We're getting it,"
the vox crackled. Hot, sulphurous gas billowed up out of the vent, and Moloch turned aside, wrinkling his nose. The rock underneath him was rumbling, vibrating with the deep subterranean pressure. The boom and flash of venting lit up along the far crags.
"Come on."
"Getting a fix now. We've fixed your signal. We're just..."
"October Country."
A hesitation.
"Moloch, confirm which biosign you are."
Moloch didn't answer. He swept around. The man facing him had almost got the drop on him. Very stealthy. Very clever. But he'd made one crucial mistake. He'd tried to take Moloch alive. Moloch made a flicking gesture with his right arm. It was unexpected and subliminally fast, but so ridiculously obvious it shouldn't have worked. Except that, as with all things, Moloch had practiced it to the point of obsession. The flick knocked the man's las pistol up out of his hand into the air. The man looked honestly surprised to be disarmed so foolishly, but he was far from defenseless. He was a psyker, a strong one. Moloch could feel it. Only the hexagramic wards tattooed on Moloch's scalp and the hairline were keeping the man's mind at bay. Moloch threw himself full length and caught the tumbling las pistol in his outstretched hand. He rolled on the rock to fire it, but the man had landed on top of him, forcing the hand holding the gun up and to the side. They were face to face, like lovers, for a moment. Moloch saw the man's sculptural, high-cheekboned face, his long black hair tied back, the set to his eyes that was noble and faintly reminiscent of the Eldar. With supreme effort, the veins in his neck bulging, Moloch slowly dragged the hand holding the gun back towards the man's head. The man grunted, trying to keep the arm bent away. Moloch pushed harder. The man headbutted Moloch squarely in the face and broke his nose. Moloch winced in pain and felt the blood stream down his cheeks. His effort relaxed involuntarily. The man clubbed Moloch's hand against the ground until the fingers broke and the gun fell out of them. Moloch gasped, hurt and furious. He threw a hasty left-hand jab that caught his adversary in the neck. It shifted the man's weight off Moloch's legs, but in delivering the jab, Moloch lost his grip on his link. The small, flat, golden device clattered away across the ivory rocks. He could hear the shipmaster's tinny voice croaking from the speaker. "Moloch! Moloch!" Moloch pulled himself away from his foe, scrambling after the link. It was right on the rim of the vent. Gas was jetting up from the chasm. The ground was shaking more than before. Sprawling on his belly, Moloch stretched for the link, but the hand his enemy had smashed against the rocks was useless, and the fingers refused to close or grip. Moloch rolled, grabbing at the link with his left hand. His scalp began to smolder. The oppressive weight of psychic power was burning out the tattooed wards, turning them into bloody welts. In another few seconds, they would be gone, and he would be open to the man's mind. He grabbed the link and struggled to his feet, shouting into it,
"Now! Now!"
His back was to the vent. The man was facing him. He'd retrieved his pistol and was aiming it at Moloch. No chances this time. No mistakes. The aim was square, the distance between them too great for Moloch to repeat his flicking trick.
"Enough," the man said. "Drop the link. I want you alive, but not that much."
Moloch raised his hand slowly, but he did not drop the link. He smiled at the man and shook his head.
"Now!"
He stepped backwards off the rim. He heard the man cry out in dismay. Then he was falling, head over heels, down and down into the deep, blackened pit, into the exhaling heat, into hell. He screamed the shipmaster's name one final time, fighting to keep his grip on the link. He saw the plasma flare surging up to meet him, a rising fireball of blossoming yellow and green. He felt his hair singe. He was falling into it, and it was rising to engulf him, to devour him, a searing white wall of... The plasma flare boomed up out of the vents and trembled on the rocks. Heat wash licked back across the crag top. The inferno withdrew and revealed the man standing beside the rim. He had encased himself in a cone of frigid air and held it there as the flare erupted around him. He had no wish to be burned away to nothing. It had been close. If the flare had lasted a few moments longer, his psychic shield would have failed. He turned. Arianod Esu Swedir was limping towards him. There was pain in her face. The man embraced her and kissed her mouth.
"Nail?"
he asked.
"He's bad. I don't think..."
The man activated his link. "Talon wishes thorn, the color of winter. Supplicant idol, with grace, reclining.
Commencing."
A moment later, they both heard the rising whine of the gun cutter's engines echoing around the valley.
"It's all right. They're on their way,"
the man told Arianod.
"Besides, we got the last of them. The one who did it."
"Are you sure?"
she asked. Gideon Ravener glanced at the smoking vent.
"Pretty damn sure," he said.
Now, Tancred, Angela Subsector, 404.M41.
"I can't ignore them much longer. I'll have to speak to them. I've been blanking their polite messages for 6 months,
and their stern demands for two. It is tiresome, but if I intend to carry on as an inquisitor of the Holy Inquisition, I must make time for them. One can be on special condition for only so long. I sit by the window and look out across the towers and high walls of Bastine, Tancred's principal city. I do not need the window to see it. I feel it. I am much less than a man, and much more. My mind inhales the city. Bastine is basking under a lazy yellow sky. The sun is a molten ball. Red stone, red brick, and red tiles soak in the heat. I feel the sunlight on my soul. I smell the enduring, intricate, feudal character of Bastine. Ink and steel pins, silk, wax, obscura smoke, veils and screens, jet shadows and scalding light. The city is rambling and convoluted, a Byzantine network of streets, alleys and buildings, wound around and over one another, with no discernible pattern or plan, no symmetry or scheme. Kadiski would have abhorred it. My mind wanders the winding lanes, passing between the cool shadows of overhung alleys into small courts and squares, where the sunlight lies on the flagstones in glaring white panels. A trader, in the shaded gloom of his premises, clacks an abacus as he makes up his ledger. A food vendor snores under his stove barrow. The barrow's oven is unlit. No one purchases hot pastries in the heat of noon. It is time to rest before the brisk business of the evening. Over here, a housekeeper steps home to her master's mansion from the wash-house, a basket of damp linen on her head. She is wondering if she dares stop to take a glass of caffeine, but is fearful that the sun will dry the linen stale and creased if she does not get it hung up. Passing her, coming up the street, are two boys with a pet simi-vulpa on a string. They are laughing at a joke that I analyze but fail to understand. Here, a servitor paints a door. The servitor's mind is empty, like an unused attic. Over there, an inker hurries to his next appointment, his wooden case of dyes and pens knocking against his hip. He is tired from a morning transcribing deeds that covered an entire shoulder blade. Behind that wall, a cook dices root vegetables for a slow-braised stew. On a nearby chopping board, the three fish he bought at the Dawn Market lie, waiting to be cleaned and portioned. They look like three silver ingots. Behind that wall, a secret garden of fig trees, just 4 meters by four, a tiny pocket of green between high-walled residences. Its owner looks down on it from his unshuttered windows and covets it, and knows that no one else knows it is there. On a roof terrace, a young man plays a viol in the sun, while his lover, another young man, sits in the shade of an awning and learns lines for his part in a play. In a cool basement lounge, a woman hesitantly questions a visiting physician about her aunt's dementia. There, a girl and a boy make love for the first time. There, an aging thief wakes up and takes a drink to steady his nerves. There, an ecclesiarch's servant scrapes wax from the temple candlesticks. There, a visiting businessman, late for his appointment, realizes he has taken a wrong turn and hurries back down the street the way he came. There, a woman sews. There, a man wonders how he's going to explain it to his wife. There, a man worries how the meeting to renew his employment contract will go at 5, not realizing that he won't make the meeting because a heart attack is going to kill him, quite suddenly, in 26 minutes. And somewhere out there. I cast my mind wider. 40 streets? 50. A radius of 2 kilometers. 5. Thousands of minds, thousands of lives, twittering on, en masse but individual, lit up to me like the stars in the heavens, some hot, some cool, some clever, some stupid, some promising, some doomed, all contained within the warren of red stone, red brick, and red tiles, soaking in the heat. And not one of them, Zygmunt Moloch. I know he's here. I can't taste him or breathe him or sense even an afterthought of him, but I know. I can't say why. I won't be able to tell the envoys why either,
when I finally decide to stop ignoring them. But this is where he's hiding. 6 months. Faint leads. False trails. And here is where I'm drawn to. I have been a servant of the Inquisition since 332, and an autonomous inquisitor since 346. A long time. Long enough to be confident that I am good at what I do. I have faith. Or am I just obsessing? The nagging idea that I have been fooling myself has come and gone with increasing regularity these last few weeks. The others feel it, I know. I see it in their faces. They're tired and frustrated with my quest. I rein back my mind and pull it in like a trawler's nets until it covers only the house around me. A leased residence, red brick built, well made. 3 floors, a grand walled courtyard, a well. There's Patience Kiss, my telekine, reclining on a stone bench in the covered walk. She has the Plays of Clocus open on her lap, a first folio, but inside it is a copy of my early work, The Mirror of Smoke. She doesn't want me to know that she's been reading it. She is too embarrassed to admit she likes what I composed. I am too embarrassed to admit I know, and that I am flattered. In the yard, there's Sholto Unworth, my erstwhile shipmaster, and his Elquan manhound, Fiflank. Fiflank is throwing a ball for the little man to chase. Shouldn't that be the other way around? Overlooking the yard, Harlan Nail thinks the same thing. He's laughing at the antics as he cleans the mechanism of an auto pistol on a small desk. I hear him call out, "Look at this now," to Maud Plighton, and she gets up from the bowl of salad she was eating and comes to join him, munching, wiping her mouth. She laughs, too. It's a deep, dirty snort. I like Maud. I'm glad she left the magistratum of Eustace Majoris to come with me in the service of the Ordos. I have hopes for her. She's as canny as Kara and, I suspect, every bit as tough as Nail. Where's Kara? Not in the library. That's Carl Thonius's domain. He's working at his cogitator, winnowing down the latest crop of leads I fed him. He's changed a lot these last few years. Since Flint, I suppose. The prissiness has gone. He's hard now, like glass, almost unreadable in his determination and reserve. He's dressing differently, behaving differently. He looks Kiss and Nail in the eye these days, and gives as good as he gets. I doubt it will be long before Interrogator Thonius is ready for his next career step. I'll sponsor him, without question. Inquisitor Thonius. It will suit him. I will miss him. I find Kara Swole in the rear bedroom. I look away again instantly. Belknap is with her. The moment they are sharing is intimate. I have no wish or right to intrude. Belknap, the medicae, is a useful addition to my party, though his manner of joining was improvised. He's a good man, fiercely religious, wonderfully skilled. He came to us when we needed a doctor to tend Kara, and stayed, I think, through love for her. They make a pretty pair. He makes her happy. I question his resolve. Such a devout, centered man might not condone some of the things that an inquisitor and his party are forced to do. I worry about Kara. There is a guarded quality to her, a guarded quality and an unspoken need. And it's been there since we were billeted in the house called Miseramus, in the 9th ward of Formal E, Petropolis. She was hurt, and we needed a doctor to save her. I don't like to pry, and I don't like to rifle through the minds of my friends without their consent, but she's hiding something from me. A heavy secret. I can guess what it is. She wants to leave. An inquisitor can only hold on to his followers for so long. Death is the most usual end to service, I'm sorry to say, but there are other circumstances. Disenchantment, incompatibility, fatigue. With Kara, it's fatigue. Kara Swole has served me loyally for a long time, and, before that, served my master, Gregor. She has been nothing but a credit, and has nothing left to prove. Chekhov's vampiric blade almost killed her. Then Patrick Belknap came along, her literal savior, and brought the prospect of a viably different lifetime commitment with him. She wants to live. She wants to live a life where hazard is not a daily expectation. She wants to step back from the duty, her duty done, and embrace the ordinary, miraculous world of love and parenting, and, I wager, grandparenting. I don't resent that. In moments of private despair, I yearn hopelessly for the same thing myself, truth be told. She's done her part, done more than the Emperor himself could have expected of a no-prospects dancer acrobat from Bonaventure. I wish her that happiness, and delight in the fact that now, for a brief moment, she has the opportunity to seize it. That opportunity won't last once we get going again. It's now, or, I fear, never. I just wish she'd decide. I wish she'd pluck up the courage and tell me. I won't rant or sulk or try to change her mind. She knows me better. I will give her my blessing, heartfelt. An inquisitor seldom gets that privilege. That said, I won't suggest it to her either. She's too good to lose. She has to tell me herself in her own time. This is, I suppose, petulant and controlling of me. I make no apologies. I am an Imperial Inquisitor. Gregor Eisenhorn taught me this control, and I can't change the way I am. Emperor knows I'd love to. There are two other people in the house with us. I roll my support chair away from the window and coast across the floor of the room. The armored chair is dark matte, ominous, sleek, suspended and propelled by the ever-turning grav hoop's whispering hum. I have lived inside it, essentially bodiless, for almost 70 years, since that day at the Spacian Gate, that day of hideous alchemy when triumph changed to atrocity, and I changed from an able, upright young man to a fused mass of burned flesh that required an armored support chair to allow me to function. It's not much, but I call it home. I slide, frictionless, down the hallway to the room where Zale sleeps. Zale is one of the other two people in the house. Wiston Frauke is the other. Wiston is sitting at Zale's bedside, his customary place. Wiston is my blunter, my untouchable, leadenly impervious to any and all psychic operation. He smokes low sticks incessantly, affects a disdainful manner, and amuses himself by reading lurid erotica. He's quite wonderful. The disdain is an act. I can read that, despite Wiston's unreadability. He has looked after Zale since the boy fell into his fugue state, his coma, his trance, whatever it is. He has carried him, washed him, read to him, watched him. And he has promised me that he will kill Zale the moment he wakes up, if Zale is what we fear he is. Zale Eternity. Zale Sleet. A low-hab stack runt from Petropolis, a vagabond kid, and also a nascent psyker, undetected by the periodic sweeps and examinations. Not just a psyker, a mirror psyker, that rarest of rare beasts. And this is the big and, potentially the most dangerous being in the sector. There exists a complex and involved series of predictions that concern the manifestation of a demon in our reality, a demon called Sleet, or Slight, or some variation. It was reckoned that Slight would incarnate because of me, or because of one of the people close to me, on Eustace Majoris, between the years 400 and 403.M41. Hundreds, perhaps millions, were predicted to perish if Slight got loose. So I was warned. I took precautions. Fate can be changed. Predictions denied. At Miseramus, during the attack that took Zeph Mathewin from us, Zale collapsed under psychic assault. At the time, the psychers bombarding him shrieked the name Slight. Zale has been catatonic ever since. Perhaps his mind couldn't take it. Perhaps his fugue state is a result of him being too weak a vessel to host a demon. When he wakes, we will know. He will wake as Zale, or he will wake as a demon clothed in flesh. If the latter is the case, then my untouchable is standing by to blunt the power of the waking demon. There is also an auto pistol in Wiston's coat pocket, so he can kill the host before it's too late. Many of my fellow inquisitors, including my beloved ex-master, would chastise me for this.
They would say I am being too lenient. They would say I am a fool, and I should take no chances whatsoever. I should extinguish Zale's life right now, while he is helpless. I choose not to. For one thing, I cannot predict how such a course of action might provoke a sleeping demon. For the other, I cannot, in all conscience, murder a teenage boy in his sleep. Zale may not be possessed. Zale may not be slight. While there is still a chance, I will not be party to his execution. Does that make me weak? Charitable? Foolish? Sentimental? Perhaps? Does it make me a radical? Yes, I think it does. Though not in the way the term is usually used. I cannot, will not, sanction Zale's death on the basis of what if. I will give him the benefit of the doubt. Throne, help me. If I'm wrong, pray Terra I can contain the damage. If I'm right, it begs the question, where is the real slight? Have we aborted his birth? Is his threat past? It's 4:04, and that puts us outside the time span of the prophecy. Far enough outside? I don't know. Does slight lurk somewhere else, beyond my knowing? Like Moloch? I don't know that, either. I just have to go with what I have. Whiston looks up as I enter the room. We do this every day. I give him a break from his steadfast vigil. All right, he asks, nodding to my sleek metal chair. I'm all right. Were you reading to him? A bedtime story. About people at bedtime. He sniggers and switches off his data slate. The boy doesn't care what I read. And if he does, it's educational. Go for a walk, I tell him. Take a nap. Whiston nods and leaves the room. The scent of his last low stick lingers after him. I bring my chair to a halt at the side of Zale's cot. His flesh is pale, his eyelids dark and sunken. He has been away a long time.
Zale, I begin. Zale, it's me, Ravenna. Just checking in. Are you well?
No response. Not even a flutter of muffled sentience. We've done this every day, so many times now.
If you can hear me, here's how things are. We won. On Eustis Majoris, we won. It was a hard fight, and the battle was costly. But we won. It was my old nemesis, Zygmunt Moloch, Zale. Dead twice at my hands, so I believed. He has a habit of coming back. He had taken the identity of the Lord Subsector and was intent on using the arcane geography of Petropolis to reawaken an ancient language.
I imagine Zale chuckling and looking confused. Even as I explain it, I realize it's such an odd story.
Enuncia, Zale. A primeval language that grants the speaker the power of creation. The power to speak a word and have that word make or destroy. He'd been years planning it. The city was the mechanism to bring it to life. And we stopped him. That's good.
Thousands of people died, but that's preferable to billions. We couldn't have allowed him to walk free, empowered like a god. I turn my chair slightly, kill the field, and drop onto the struts. The hooves of the struts sink into the carpet.
The bad part is, Moloch escaped. Hurt, but alive, and in company with several dangerous individuals. Chief amongst them is a cult facilitator named Orfeo Kalzian. Kalzian is enormously pernicious. So is Moloch. Together.
Zale does not move. He does not react in any way. He sleeps like death is his sleep.
It's my duty to find them, to hunt down Moloch before he can regroup and try another scheme. That's the way he works, you see. Long-term plans. He doesn't think twice about embarking on a scheme that might take years, decades, to reach fruition. This I know about him.
I've been sparring with him for more than 70 years. I dearly wish he'd stayed dead. There was a school sale, an academy, private, esoteric, long since closed down. It existed about a century ago. It was run by a renegade called Lillian Chase, now long dead. Its aim was to develop, by means psychic, eugenic, and noetic, a generation of people who would work to further the cause of chaos in this sector. Every one of them was a genius, a devil, a monster. They, and their handiwork, have plagued the Inquisition for decades. A secret society, a weapons-grade secret society. Moloch was one of the Academy's graduates, one of Chase's star pupils. His intellect was astonishing, and it was tempered with extraordinary noetic training. Zygmunt Moloch, you see, is one of the Inquisitor's most wanted. He is abominably malicious. He is cognite. So, that's why I'm chasing him. It's not enough we thwarted him on Eustace Majoris. He's still alive, and we have to track him down and finish him before he can rise again. Nothing in my career is more important or vital than this. Not the Gomek violation, or even the Servan-Holman affair on Sarum, which, incidentally, I'm sure Moloch had a hand in. Tracking and executing Zygmunt Moloch is the single most important thing I can ever do with my curious life. I regarded his so innocently sleeping form. Zael Sleet. Or is that slight? The single most important thing, I hope. Anyway, we're close. I think we have him. He's here. By which I mean, he's where we are. Tancred. One jump stop down from your homeworld, Eustace Majoris. The trouble is, the Ordos want to reel me back in. I left Eustace Majoris in a mess. They want a report, and my explanation. They won't wait any longer. I risk losing my warrant and being denounced as a rogue element. I don't like it, Zael. But I have to stop and answer to my masters. I just hope I can find and finish Moloch before they take away my rosette. I pause. Well, that's me. How are you, Zael? He doesn't respond. I don't expect him to. I hear the door open behind me and presume it's Whiston. It's not. It's Carl.
The envoys have arrived, he says.
Have they? Very well. I'll be down directly.
Zael sleeps on, unperturbed.
I engage my chair's lift field, turn, and follow Carl out of the room. To face, as they say, the music. Part 1. A matter of the most pleasant fraternal confidence. Chapter 1. It took a certain sort of man to perform 8 ritual killings in 3 hours, and he was, without doubt, that sort of man. Each killing was random, opportunistic, each one carried out with wildly different methods and weapons. The first, with a purloined knife, looked like a backstreet mugging. The second, a strangulation, was made to seem like a sex crime. The third and fourth, together, would later appear to be a drunken argument over cards that ended with both parties shooting one another simultaneously. The fifth, a poisoning, would have any Medicare examiner blaming poorly preserved shellfish. The sixth and seventh, also simultaneous, were electrocutions, and made faulty hab wiring seem responsible. The eighth, the most grisly, was staged to resemble a robbery gone wrong. She finally caught up with him during the 8th murder. A local moneylender and part-time fence owned a house on the lower pavements behind the Basilica Mechanicus. He had slipped in through the back kitchen, found the moneylender alone in a shuttered study, and bludgeoned him to death with a votive statue of St. Kyodrus. Then he'd removed some paper money orders and gold bars from the moneylender's floor safe to cement the notion of a robbery.
"What are you doing?" she asked,
cautiously entering the gloomy room behind him.
The rank, metallic stink of blood choked the close air. Bent over the body, he glanced at her.
What needs to be done?
He reached down and did something to the blood-stained corpse.
You don't need that,
he added. She kept the snub-nosed Hoztec 5 aimed at the back of his head.
I'll be the judge of what I need, she replied.
Really, you don't need that,
he repeated, using the tone of command this time. She lowered her aim, but she was strong and well-trained. She didn't put the gun away.
This is madness, she said. You were told to stay in the exclave. Secrecy is paramount. To walk abroad invites discovery. And this killing.
Her voice caught on the word. Layla Slade was not a squeamish woman. She'd done her fair share of killing, but it had always been professional work. She'd never killed for pleasure or to appease some mental deviation. She was disappointed with him, he could tell. He didn't really care, because Layla Slade wasn't very important in the grand sweep of things. But, for the moment, there were good reasons for keeping her on his side. She was one of his few friends in the cosmos. He could see the disgust on her face, as if she was being asked to babysit some sociopath. She didn't understand. He decided it was time she did. If nothing else, he didn't like the idea that she considered him to be a homicidal pervert.
You think I'm killing for kicks?
He asked. Layla shrugged.
It looks like what it looks like. I don't care what kind of animal you are. I just get paid to mind you. In this case, that means dragging your psycho ass back to the exclave.
He rose to his feet, facing her. The body on the floor lay in an undignified heap, one slipper off, one stockinged toe turned at right angles. The clothes had been ruffled and disarrayed by the fury of the attack. The votive statue of St. Kyodris had made a pink pulp of the moneylender's face.
And if I don't want to go back to the exclave?
He asked.
Well, I'm not sure I can force you. I have no doubt of your abilities. At the very least, though, we'll hurt each other. A lot.
He nodded and smiled. The smile was genuine.
Yes, I believe we would. I like you because you're honest about these things. We would hurt each other. Let's not.
Let's not. Agreed. Now, are you coming back?
Soon. Let's talk first, Layla.
She raised the gun.
No. No negotiation. We're going back.
He nodded, half turned, and made some kind of quick flicking gesture with his right arm. She flinched, felt a slight impact against her wrist, and then the Hoztec 5 was in his right hand. He aimed it at her. He expected anger, dismay, perhaps even a futile attempt to retake possession of the weapon. Instead, she said,
"Teach me to do that."
They cleaned the moneylender's house of incriminating traces and left the victim on the floor of his study beside the open floor safe. He stood patiently while she dabbed the specks of impact spatter blood from his face and neck with a wet cloth. His clothes were black, and the rest wouldn't show.
A robber would set fire to cover the body if a burglary had gone wrong,
she suggested.
Oh.
He had already overturned a lamp bowl, and small blue flames were dancing along the edge of the rug. 5 streets from the moneylender's hab, they entered a small eating house and took a table at the back. Layla selected the place because of the low light levels and the fact they could sit away from the street. She ordered a pitcher of petal water, sweetmeats, a cauldron of lemon and chile rice, and a carafe of the local red wine.
This is nice, he said.
It's not. You still have my gun.
He displayed his hands, open. They were very pale, very expressive. She frowned, reached inside her jacket, and found her Hoztec 5 secure in its rig.
You can teach me how to do that, too.
If you like. Are you eager to learn?
Some things. I have skills, and they earn me a market price. My skills are good enough to please my master, and he teaches me some of his skills, too.
I'm sure he does.
But a girl always wants to learn new things, from a man like you.
Like me. My dear Layla, not so many minutes passed, you characterize me as a deviant killer, a psycho.
She shrugged.
With skills, she said.
He laughed. She was a piece of work. When the time came, he might even spare her. Or at least kill her mercifully. The food arrived. The waitress gave them no more than a passing look. A couple taking a late lunch. An off-worlder girl, tall, built like a swimmer, with short fair hair and a hard, unforgiving face. And what? Her lover? Her employer? A slender man, dignified, dressed in black, with a hairless face that, though handsome, seemed uncomfortably asymmetrical. Layla picked at the rice.
You wanted to talk?
He poured some wine.
6 months since we left Eustace Majoris,
he said.
All that while, you've sheltered me, kept me hidden, in your custody.
For safety.
I understand. I appreciate that. I also appreciate, if I haven't told you, the efforts you and the others have made to secure my safety.
It doesn't look that way. The first opportunity you get, you slip away from us and go off into a strange city, killing.
There's that, he nodded.
So?
She had no desire to tell him the truth. No need to let him in on the fact that her master had told her to allow his escape and to monitor it.
Our principal is getting stir-crazy, Leigh,
Orfeo Kalzean had said.
He's kicking his heels, pacing the cage. Let him out for a while. Let him think he's given us the slip. Give him his head for an hour or two, but tail him and bring him back before he, oh, I don't know, tries to undermine the planetary government or something.
Layla Slade had laughed.
I'll watch him, she'd promised, if all he wants is a bit of fresh air.
Moloch took a finger pinch of rice, added a sweetmeat, and slid the load into his mouth. He munched and then washed it down with a sip of petal water.
I needed to get out,
he said.
I have been handled for too long. By you, and before that, by my secretists at Petropolis. My life has been lived according to the timetables of others. I needed to walk, free.
If you'd asked, it could have been arranged.
If it had been arranged, then it wouldn't have been freedom, would it?
Point.
She conceded. He sat back.
On Eustace Majoris, Layla, I came so close. I came so close to doing something extraordinary. Something that would have changed the Imperium forever. Ended it, probably. But I was thwarted, and I failed. And you and your master were on hand to pull me out of the fire and bundle me away. Now your master and I work on new schemes.
But...
Do you know who I serve, Layla?
Yourself? The deep time plans of the Cognitae?
Yes. And before all of those things?
She shrugged.
I won't speak their names aloud, or all the food in this emporium will spoil, and all the wine turn to vinegar. They are ruinous powers.
I understand.
Good. So you see, I had to give thanks. Though my mission to Eustace Majoris failed, I escaped with my life to continue my work. I had to give thanks for that.
Orfeo would...
Dear Orfeo doesn't really understand. I don't know what he tells you he is, Layla, but he's a mercenary. A prostitute. Brilliant, skilled, talented, but he works for money. I don't do what I do for money, or even power, as power is understood by the grandees of this Imperium of Man. I am, I suppose, a man of quite strong religious beliefs.
You needed to give thanks, she asked,
drinking a sip of water.
To the old gods I serve. I had to make appeasement, benediction. I had to make a sacrifice of thanks for deliverance, even though that meant risking discovery. A sacrifice must honor the Eight. For eight is the symbol. Eight-pointed. A common follower might have killed eight at the eighth house on the eighth street in the eighth enclave at eight in the evening, but I eschew such crudity. The agents of the throne would have recognized the occult significance in a moment. Even they are not that stupid. So I made eight subtle sacrifices that, according to inspection, would seem random and unconnected.
But they still have ritual purpose.
He nodded. He ate some more and drank some wine. She refilled his glass.
the beggar in the alley. I made 8 incisions with a knife that weighed 8 ounces. I did this at 8 minutes to the hour. The housemaid had 8 moles on her left thigh and took 8 minutes to suffocate. I was very particular. The gamblers both held double 8s in their hands, and 8 shots were discharged, and so on. The moneylender, killed at 8 minutes past the hour, was slain with 8 primary blows, no more, no less, and had been busy accounting the books for the 8th trading month. I anointed all the bodies with certain marks and runes, all made in water now long evaporated. It was a ritual, Layla. It was worship. It was not the act of a psychopath.
I see that now, she said. He felt her remark was perhaps sardonic. He half smiled anyway, and drank some water. Such an extraordinary level of detail, she added, scooping up more rice, to plan it like that.
I was taught to improvise. Layla, I don't mean to be rude, but I don't think like you think. My mind doesn't work like yours does.
Really?
I was trained from birth to utilize the full dynamic of my mind. Trained in noetic techniques that give me an edge, more than an edge. What would take another man a week to plan, I can do in a moment.
Really? She repeated. He enjoyed the hauteur in her voice, the scorn. She was tolerating him.
Really? Layla, I'm not boasting or showing off. This is what the cognitate does to a mind. Acute observation, for a start. The ability to read low-level, passive body language. The ability to notice and compare, to analyze, to predict.
Prove it.
He lifted his glass and smiled.
Where would you like me to start?
He asked.
Oh, you go right ahead.
How many buttons did the waitress have on her bodice?
Layla hunched her shoulders.
6.
6, correct. Good. How many were undone?
2, she said.
Well noticed. The top 2?
No, the top 1 and the bottom 1. Her hips were wide.
Again, excellent. Are you sure you haven't had cognitate training, Layla?
She snorted.
All you've proved is we both like to look at pretty girls.
Dressed in?
What?
Dressed in.
A bodice?
The silk from?
Hesperus.
Good. But no. Sameter. The weave is tighter, and there is a rumpled quality, a ruching, to sameter silk. And the buttons were made on Gudrun.
Really?
They were gold, and had a hallmark. As she leaned over...
Layla put down her glass.
You're making this up.
Am I? The man at the booth next to us. We passed him on the way in. Rogue trader. Armed. Where was his concealed weapon?
Left armpit. I saw the bulge. Got a blade in his right boot, too, under the hem of the trouser.
You are sharp.
It's my business to know.
Was his moustache longer on the left or right?
Why does that matter?
Shorter on the right, because he smokes an obscura pipe, and the hairs don't grow so fast on the side he sucks the mouthpiece. You could see it in his mannerisms, with the low stick. A habitual rise and draw. Which means?
He'll be unpredictable. And jumpy. Obscura does that.
Now you're learning.
It means nothing, she laughed.
The man by the window. Left or right-handed?
Right. He's drumming the fingers of his right hand on the tabletop beside his cup of caffeine.
Wrong. He's watching the street crowd, because he's waiting for a business partner he doesn't know. His left hand is under the table, on the butt of his weapon. A Hecuta model, badly stowed. The right hand is a distraction.
Layla shook her head.
Should I go over and ask him to prove it?
If you want to get shot. The barman, 19th Gudrunite Irregulars, a guard veteran.
Why?
Tattoo on his left wrist. Company of Angels. The vets of the 19th took that as a tat after Ladislaw Heights.
You can see that.
Not from here, but on the way in. And you?
Me?
You've eaten enough. You're full. But you like the rice, so you keep picking at it, even though you don't want it.
It's good rice.
And you haven't touched your wine in 13 minutes. You keep playing with the glass, but you don't drink, because you're afraid that if you get merry, you'll lose control of this situation. But you play with the glass all the same, so as not to draw attention to the fact you're not drinking.
That's just nonsense.
Is it? He looked at her. You sit slightly sidelong to me, favoring your left buttock, because your right hip gives you pain. Old wound? An augmetic?
She breathed out.
An augmetic.
Moloch clapped his hands.
You dearly want to go back now, but you're afraid of goading me, or having to force me. You want to make it seem like my idea.
Now look.
You're quite certain I don't know that Orfeo instructed you to let me loose for a few hours. Orfeo thinks I'm going stir-crazy. The idea was to let me walk around and blow off steam.
Damn it, Moloch.
Don't damn it at all. Enjoy it. What could I do you suppose? What could I do, just sitting here?
I don't know.
Moloch removed a tiny fowl from his sleeve and put it on the tabletop beside the cauldron of rice.
Ossical plague, in suspension. I took it from Orfeo's personal kit. If I release it here, I could decimate the entire city quarter.
For the love of... No!
I won't. There'd be no sense in that. But consider the options. The banker at the table to our left. He works at the city mint. He has a brooch on his waistcoat, before you ask. The sigil of the banking guild. And the office of coinage circulation. If I dropped the file into his business case, he would find it and open it when he returned to his office. The mint would be contaminated and would have to be sealed off for 15 years. The local currency would crash and bring the subsector economy down. Decades of damage. Or take that young man over there, the one in the private booth. He's the second son of a minor baron, slumming it. But I know he's in with the court crowd.
Moloch produced a small medical injector from his pocket and put it down on the table beside the file. It was full of clear fluid.
Suspension liquid. Inert and viscous. Metabolized in 6 hours. I could go into the washrooms, load the plague solution into it, and bump into that second son as I came back. In a day or two, the entire royal house of this planet would be dead from contact plague. An ideal moment to stage a coup.
But that's just...
she whispered.
Now you're getting the idea, he said. What about this? That drunk by the bar. I've been gently hypnotizing him with finger movements since we came in. Allow me to prove it.
Moloch moved his fingers. The drunken man lurched and tottered over to them.
What's your name?
Moloch asked.
Sir Garnis Govior, sir,
the man wulled.
And your job?
I am chief under-translator to the house of the governor, sir.
Layla stared at Moloch.
And you thought I'd let you pick this bar?
He smiled.
It's a famous haunt of the administratum classes. I noticed Garnis here because of his signet ring.
This ring?
The man asked, displaying it so abruptly he swayed.
The very same. You have FaceTime with the governor, then?
I do, sir, I surely do,
the man said, wobbling.
So, if I asked you to strangle him the next time you saw him, setting off a local sector war that would bring in houses Gavon, Nightbray, and Clovis, you'd have no problem?
None at all, the man assured Moloch. Not a problem at all.
You'd strangle the Lord Governor? Layla asked.
Like a bloody shot. Like he was a bloody whelp. Yes, ma'am.
But I won't, said Moloch. You can go now, Garnis.
Thank you kindly,
the man said, and staggered off. Moloch looked at the wide-eyed Layla.
Every opening, every chance, every chink. That's what the cognite are trained to do. To look, to see, to find, to use. In the course of this delightful lunch, Layla, I could have brought the subsector down 3 or 4 times over, just like that.
He flicked something away with his thumb. It landed on the floor of the bar and broke, oozing fluid.
Oh, holy,
Layla began.
Relax.
It's just the suspension fluid. The plague's in my pocket. So, let's consider the Inquisition.
The Inquisition?
Most particularly, the office of the Ordos on this world.
You can't see that from here?
Oh, I can. In the overbar mirror. See?
Terra, I hadn't noticed that. He sipped his wine.
I could see the fortress of the Inquisition from my seat. Such a big fortress, towering over the city. It was built by the Black Templars, you know. Long since vacated, but one day they might be back. Until then, the Inquisition uses the keep. It's going to be a bloody fight the day the Templars return. Anyway, they're flying flags. Several dark flags. What does that mean?
Does it mean anything? They're flying flags.
The Inquisition doesn't suppose anyone understands their protocols and heraldry. Black flags above their fortress. Just for show. Just for threat. But I have made it my business to understand and monitor the way they signal to one another.
So? I can barely see the mirror from where I'm sitting.
I'll tell you what it means. The flags are the black crests of Siquo, Belloc, and Quist. Symbols the Inquisition identify with respect and honor. They are flying ceremonially. There are envoys in residence. Several high-ranking envoys. Actually, you can tell that simply by the number of weapon ports they've uncovered. Someone important is here.
Meaning?
Meaning Ravenna's here, as we feared, and they've decided to rein him in, which is good news for us.
There was a sudden, brutal crash. Voices around the eating house rose in alarm. Garnis had slipped over in the pool of suspension fluid and brained himself on the edge of the bar rail. He was dead.
Let's go,
said Moloch. They rose and picked their way out of the eating house, moving around the crowd that had gathered around Garnis's misfortune.
That's 9, Layla whispered. I thought you only wanted 8.
I did, but I'm not stupid. This one isn't ritual. This is a 9th to ruin the pattern. The Ordos are sharp and clever. They would have seen a pattern of 8, except for this.
He bent down in the edge of the crowd and picked up a small piece of the broken glass phial Garnis had slipped on.
A present, he said. A deodand for your master.
I'm sure he'll love it, said Layla Slade. Wait, she added.
He paused. She licked her right index finger, reached out, and wiped away one last lone speck of blood from his face that she'd missed earlier.
Thank you, he said.
They stepped out into the bright day, and the bustling crowd swallowed them up. Chapter 2 At her master's mind-whispered instruction, Patience Kiss opened the courtyard gates to let them in. She didn't move from her seat on the stone bench. One nod of her head, one blink of her green eyes, and invisible hawsers of telekinetic power drew the heavy timber doors open. The lower edges of the doors scraped slightly on the ground and lifted a small cloud of dust from the dry cobbles. The doors made a juddering, rumbling sound as they swung in. Fierce patches of yellow sunlight invaded the quiet shade of the courtyard through the opening gates. Nail, Thonius, and Plighton came out of the house to watch the arrival. Nail's expression was unreadable. The skin of his shaved scalp had caught a touch of sun. He wore a tight grey body glove, reinforced with articulated ceramite plates around the shoulders, neck, and torso. He stood at the top of the house steps, in the shadow of the entrance archway, adjusting his gloves. He made no attempt to conceal the Hecuta arms midguard holstered on his left hip. Maud Plighton emerged to stand next to him. She had taken to wearing navy surplus fatigues since quitting the magistratum. Today, she had chosen a one-piece zip-front flight suit of shabby khaki, heavy-laced combat boots, and a white undervest. The unflattering fit of the unisex clothing accentuated her large, slightly thick-set frame, a build that contrasted sharply with the very delicate pinch of her features. She wore her dark hair cropped short, a magistratum regulation she had found it hard to abandon. Carl Thonius, slender and trim, wore the bottom half of a black body glove and the high patent leather boots of a ceremonial cavalry officer, complete with rowel spurs that clinked when he walked. On his upper half he wore a purple tailcoat with gold trim. Open, the coat framed a rectangle of scrawny white chest and washboard stomach above the glove's waistband. His long fingers were covered in rings, and his hair was dyed black and roughly chopped into a mane. He was a long way from the fey, fussy, impeccably dressed dandy who had first joined the Inquisitor's company a decade before.
"Do we know who it is?"
Nail asked him. Carl shook his head. "Not a clue." Across the yard, Kara and Belknap emerged from another doorway. Kara was short, voluptuous, her bright red hair stridently clashing with her lime-green vest and white pantaloons. Belknap, dressed in simple black combat trousers, was a slim man of average build, his hair short and unremarkably brown, his face unexceptionally ordinary, except for a sleepy glitter of intense wisdom and reassurance in his eyes. Those eyes had seen a lot as a battlefield medique. They would see a whole lot more as the private physician to an Inquisitor's warband. Patience Kiss, tall and feline, rose from the bench at last and joined Kara and Belknap. In her dark brown body glove, she seemed all legs. Her black hair was hanging loose, but as she walked, she reached up with her hands, gathered it, and twisted it into a neat tail that she secured with a silver pin.
"Brace yourselves," she said. "I smell trouble."
The envoys entered the courtyard. First an outrider on a long, low, powerful warbike, its engine issuing an indignant splutter that resonated around the courtyard walls. Then, one after another, three chimera carriers, like monolithic stone blocks, their track sections clattering and squealing. The carriers were finished in a matte grey, as if they were supposed to be incognito. As if a trio of 38-ton armoured vehicles could be incognito. Their turbines grumbling, they drew up on the lower part of the courtyard, side by side. Six cyberskulls droned in with them and took up hovering stations, like dragonflies. A second outrider, low on his machine like the first, brought up the rear. This second bike raced around the parked carriers and halted, revving. The rider put one foot down and sat up. In a line, bike, carrier, 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 bike.
"Close the gates."
Kiss nodded and obliged. The gates rumbled shut. The carriers shut down their engines. Exhaust fumes drifted away, up and out of the yard.
"Leave this to me,"
said Nail. "Why?" asked Carl.
"Look at my face. Am I about to take any shit?"
Carl smiled and nodded.
"No, and I like that about you."
Nail looked at Maud.
"Got a piece?"
"I thought they were friends."
"No such thing, girl. Go get a piece and stay inside behind the door."
Maud looked back at Nail, waiting for the punchline. Then she realized he was serious and disappeared back into the house. Harlan Nail left Thonius on the steps and stomped down into the sunlight. He walked towards the line of vehicles. The hovering cyberskulls whirred and buzzed, bobbing slightly as he came into range. The two outriders had killed the engines of their warbikes and rocked them over onto their stands. Both dismounted. They were clad in matching scale-armored body gloves, smeared in dust, which made them look like extensions of their matte black and bare metal bikes. They removed their helmets, yanking free the skeins of wires and plugs that linked them to the weapon systems of the bikes. The rider on the left was a young male, tall and slightly built, with long white hair that shook free and loose the moment his helmet was off. He looked at Nail. He had the most distressingly blue eyes.
"We greet the master of the house, and humbly thank him for this audience," he said.
His voice was soft and clear, like rainwater.
"The greeting is returned," said Nail.
He flicked his eyes up at the hovering cyberskulls.
"A little too many guns around for this to be cordial."
The young man smiled broadly.
"I apologize," he said.
He took a control wand from his hip pocket and waved it. With a low murmur, the skulls deactivated and sank to the courtyard floor.
"That was rude. Just a precaution, you realize."
He pocketed the wand, hung his helmet on the antlers of his bike, and walked towards Nail.
"Interrogator Gol Balak," he said.
extending a hand the moment he'd peeled the glove off.
Nail,
said Nail, shaking the hand.
I know,
said Balak.
I have studied the records. I'm an admirer of your work. Where's Ravener?
By that, I suppose you mean Inquisitor Ravener,
Nail replied. Balak pursed his lips and nodded.
Presumptuous of me, and lacking respect. Of course, I meant Inquisitor Ravener.
He's inside.
My senior has come to speak with him.
Perhaps your senior would like to get out of his tank and come in, then,
said Nail. Balak snorted a laugh.
You know, Harlan, I think she might just do that.
There was a series of pneumatic clanks, and the boarding hatches of the Chimeras began to open. Over in the shadows, Kiss jerked her head at Kara, and the pair of them slipped away into the house. Belknap, slightly at a loss, stayed put. The second outrider had taken off his helmet. He was a she. A very tall she, with long, braided, beaded hair.
Shit,
whispered Harlan Nail.
Great throne of terror. You're seeing this?
Nail murmured.
Of course. She's the dead spit,
Nail said.
It's uncanny. This will be weird for you, then, I guess. I can do weird, Harlan. I'm a professional. Even so, bring them in. Let's get this done.
People dismounted from the carriers. 2 dozen troopers with mixed weapons, all of them wearing the rosette of the Ordos. An old man with a cane. A tiny child-framed woman in Selpic blue leading a pair of servitor gunhounds. An Ogryn slave to a massive plasma cannon. A woman and a man in long leather coats. A quartet of rubricators with their writing machines. A man in shiny jet body armor, and another woman, ash blonde, slender, dressed in a long gown of ochre hydrofur silk. She was impressive. The sight of her made Nail suck in his breath. Then the chief envoy. Her body was armored in red plate, and she walked with a limp. Every centimeter of her armor was engraved and covered with seals. The parchment scrolls hung off her like feathers, as if she was fledged like a bird.
Well, I should be flattered, I suppose.
Yeah,
whispered Nail.
Why?
That's Inquisitor Mizard, senior secretary to the Ordo's Helican, and Lord Rawkin's immediate subordinate.
Throne. They're not playing around, then, are they?
Mizard limped across the yard to Nail. She looked up into his face. She had once, Nail could tell, been a beautiful woman. Strong, articulate, animated. Her face was lined now, contoured by extreme age. Her hair was straw gold.
Are you the interrogator?
She asked in a brittle, tired voice.
Are you Thonius?
This is Nail, ma'am,
Balak said gently.
The thug,
Nail suggested with a rogue smile, extending his hand. Mizard grinned and shook his hand.
I like you already,
she warned.
Where's that bastard Ravener? I need to have words.
As I just said, he's inside. And I'm sure he's got some of his own.
Mizard laughed again.
I do like you. Spunky. Let's go and talk to Gideon, shall we?
Allow me to lead you in, ma'am,
Thonius said, hurrying down the steps with a hand extended. I'm Interrogator Thonius. My master is awaiting your pleasure. Mizard sniffed.
I've been awaiting my pleasure for 68 years, she glanced at Nail. Possibly I found it now, though.
Nail looked at Carl and mouthed,
Help me.
Carl smiled.
This way, ma'am.
They filed in past Nail, up into the house. The gunhounds barked at him as they were led by. The woman in ochre, the ash blonde, turned Nail's head as she passed. She didn't look at him. They had gone in towards the house, and only the female outrider remained, standing by the parked vehicles. Nail walked over to her.
We had better go in, he said.
She nodded. She was taller than he was.
I have to ask, he said.
Esu Swedir?
You know the Carthayan clans?
I knew one of their number once. A long time ago. Arianad.
My mother's sister.
I am Angarad.
He made the sign of the Aquila. Harlan Nail. You should know my master was deeply in love with your aunt a long time ago.
I know this too. I know she died by his side. She was the reason I joined the Inquisition's service.
Angarad returned his respectful Aquila with the fist punch to sternum salute of Carthy. He waited while she untied her long, sheathed saber from the warbike's frame.
Let's go in, he said.
Let's.
If you don't mind me asking, what's its name?
She cinched the sword harness tighter around her shoulder.
Eviscerex, she replied.
Chapter 3. I sit waiting for them, in a pool of sunlight in the drawing room. I have banished my party to the far corners of the house, just in case. The only ones I allow to be present are Carl Thonius, leading the visitors in, and Harlan Nail, bringing up the rear. Nail is walking with the woman Angharad. I find I am insanely jealous. Arianad was the only woman I ever loved in my physical life. She died just a few short months before I was maimed and reduced to this state, and somehow, tragically, that had made it better. If Arianod had still been there, I would have killed myself. Killed myself without a doubt. But she had died first. I had coped with all of my loss. And now, her doppelganger appears. A Carthayan swordswoman so physically reminiscent of my long-lost love, it is painful. I turn my chair to face Mizard.
Gideon, she announces, good to see you.
And you, Ermina. Do you have any objections to thought conference? I can kick in my voxponder.
Mine's fine,
she says, and sits down on a tub chair that groans.
Meet the others,
she says.
Damar Singh.
The tiny woman with the gun hounds nods. The hounds snuffle and whine.
Tarkos Mentator.
The old savant, bent on his cane, also nods.
Shuguth.
The Ogryn bows.
Interrogator Claudel and Interrogator Gonzale. Interrogator Balak.
The man and the woman in the long coats snap to attention. Balak inclines his head with a smile, his face framed by his long, white hair.
Angharad Esuswedir.
The towering swordswoman beside Nail makes no movement whatsoever.
Inquisitor Fengs?
The man in the black body armor makes the sign of the Aquila.
And this is Inquisitor Lilith.
The woman in the ochre gown with the ash-blonde hair offers me a respectful nod.
Lilith, I've read your work and admire it. You have, I understand, a particular interest in the Eldar xenotype.
I have, sir, and I have read your works, too, and adored it,
she answered. Thank you.
Well, now everyone loves everyone else, says Mizard. Let's get to business. Gideon, you have to stop. You are this close to being branded a rogue.
She holds up her left hand and pinches the forefinger towards the thumb to indicate the distance. I open the slot on the forecasing of my chair and display my blue rosette. I am operating under special condition, and my Lord Rorkan knows this. Mizard folds her hands.
Such an understanding goes only so far. It's time to stop.
Moloch is still out there, Thonius says.
My own interrogator, Carl Thonius, I send.
We've met, says Mizard. Yes, Moloch is out there, but he's a loose end that others can deal with. You are requested to stop.
Requested?
Mizard sniffs.
Ordered. Requested is so much more mealy-mouthed. We've been requesting you for months, and you've been avoiding us. Now it's an order.
From my lord? The senior envoy nods her head. Fenks steps forward and draws a sealed data slate from his belt pouch. He holds it awkwardly for a moment and stares at my chair.
Is there somewhere I can insert this. I have an idea,
mutters Nail from the back of the room. Mizard sniggers.
Play nice, Gideon. Data port?
I open a data port on the side of my chair unit, and Fenks loads the slate. I open it, spin it out, and extend the hololithic display around me in my dark cocoon of virtual light. The missive has been recorded by my Lord Rorkan, personally. It was as if I was standing next to him. He looks tired, frustrated. He says my name. I kill the rest of the sequence. I don't need to see any more. Rorkan is the only man I answer to, and he has spoken. All right. I'll come back in. There. It wasn't so painful, was it, Amina?
Thankfully, no, Gideon. Look, you have to understand, you're not about to be censured. Rorkan is pleased with your work. So am I, damn it. On Eustace, you did an extraordinary thing. You stopped something that could have destroyed everything. All of us.
Oh, so you have read my report.
Cover to cover, says Lilith. But it is the very magnitude of the event that forces your recall, sir. Enuncia alone, and the collective knowledge of it gathered by your team, must be examined in forensic detail. Forgive me, curt report is not enough.
And there is the matter of Eustace Majoris itself,
says the savant mentator. His voice is as involved and thready as old fused wiring.
What matter might that be? Thonius asks.
The damage,
says Mentator.
The destruction. The deaths.
Am I to be held responsible?
Oh, for goodness sake, Gideon,
Mizard says, getting to her feet and looking around the room.
It's going to take years to rebuild the subsector capital. This whole region is in crisis, you understand. Crisis?
I know what crisis means.
18 planetary governments about to fall. There are currency issues, faith issues.
Interrogator Balak was speaking fast, quietly.
A loss of belief in imperial rule. General unrest. Strikes and civil disobedience on 9 major planets. A mutiny at the navy yards on Lenk. The list is extensive. I won't bother you with every detail, but you need to understand. If Moloch had succeeded, he would have busted this subsector. This sector, even. Apart at the seams. You stopped him. But the price of you stopping him was still extensive. Scarra's sector is damaged and fragile. Repairing the infrastructure will take generations. We need your help.
My help?
It is essential that you and every member of your team is extensively debriefed,
says Interrogator Gonzale.
That process might take months. We can learn from you, Inquisitor, and what we learn from you may save us years in the rebuilding process.
Put simply, says Mizard, you can't just make a big old mess and leave others to clean it up.
I know this. I have been avoiding it. It is a necessary part of any Inquisitor's work. After the Gomek violation, I spent 3 years in restorative cooperative study with the planetary government. After the Nassar case, my old master Gregor Eisenhorn devoted the better part of a decade on Messina, tidying up behind himself. After the Necron Wars, Inquisitor Bylock, blessed be his memory, set aside the remainder of his life to repairing the governments and substrate of the Tarquin stars. Mizard is still looking around. Carl, perhaps you could rustle up some wine and some food for our guests. Carl nods.
No problem, sir. That's very kind of you, Gideon,
Mizard says, sitting down again.
What about Moloch?
Nail asks. Everyone looks around at him.
Did I say that out loud?
He adds.
Good. What about Moloch?
What about him?
Asks Fenks.
He's loose. He's free. He's out there.
Out where?
Asks Inquisitor Lilith. Nail shrugs a shoulder.
Out there, in Bastine. We've no reason to suppose he's here, says Fenks. Haven't you?
Nail asks.
We have.
Evidence it, demands Claudel. Nail pauses. I feel for him. He is so loyal.
I can't just do that.
It's a hunch.
Mizard stares at my chair.
A hunch?
Don't look at me like that, Amina. A hunch.
Yes, a hunch. I do that. And look what I do.
So noted. I trust you. But a hunch.
He's here.
A hunch is not enough.
I have faith. Mizard and Fenks exchange looks. Moloch must be brought in. He's been at large for too many years. He's rabidly dangerous. That's why I've stayed out so long, ignoring your calls. I have to bring him in.
You're too close, Gideon.
That's why I'm the one to do it.
No, you're too close, Gideon,
Mizard repeats. Carl comes back in with a tray of drinks, and Mizard takes one.
Moloch is your nemesis. You're twinned in destiny. Such a long, involved duel you've fought down the years. You're too close. It's becoming a disadvantage.
I don't believe so. She sips her drink.
That's your prerogative. But I'm telling you this, Gideon. In all frankness, the reason you've never brought Moloch down is that you're too close and therefore not the man to do it.
Rubbish.
How many times have you killed him now?
Lilith asks.
Two? Three?
He's tenacious.
He's nigh on bloody invulnerable to you.
Mizard smiles.
Moloch isn't here, Gideon. He's fled. You're obsessed and tired and too long on the chase. You're needed elsewhere. Let other, fresher minds hunt Moloch down.
You might be right, I concede.
I am right. Good wine, by the way.
Mizard puts her glass down. I'll take your word for it.
We are very able, Inquisitor,
says Fenks.
I'm sure you are, sir.
We will find Moloch and bring him to justice,
says Lilith. Am I allowed to ask how? Mizard nods.
We have agents active all across the subsector. Some are uncovering strong leads. Fenks and his team leave Tancred tonight for Sancor. In 2 days, Lilith and her party head out for Ingeren. 6 hours later, my interrogator here, Balak, commands a party to the Halo Stars.
You say you have leads?
Currency accounts on Sancor have been traced to Moloch, says Fenks. They've been accessed in the last month. That's a strong lead.
I have sourced Cognite holdings on Ingeren to Moloch, says Lilith.
Orfeo Kalzean has territory there. Someone is trying to dissolve those assets. That's also a strong lead.
Orfeo Kalzean's collection of Diodans was shipped out via an unnamed cash wafer to Encage 3 weeks ago, says Balak. The collection had been held by the hotel at Petropolis. They were routed as cargo on a bulk trader.
I know. Don't waste your time. It's a double blind.
Balak shrugs.
We'll see.
It's over, Gideon. You can stop now and rest,
Mizard says. All right, I sent. He's your problem now. Just don't come crying to me when...
Might I have some more wine?
Mizard asks, holding up her glass.
You're just going to roll over on this?
Kara asks after Mizard has gone. I think so. Do you really want to spend the rest of your life hunting Moloch? She stands beside me in the courtyard of the house. Evening has stretched the shadows out into long grey lines.
No,
she answers. She looks at me.
Because I don't believe it will take the rest of our lives.
Because we're close.
Because we're close. You believe so? So does patience. You feel it.
It's still just a hunch. I have no solid proof. I felt quite embarrassed trying to explain it to Mizard and her people, trying to justify...
What?
Gregor trained me to follow my instinct, but he also warned me against obsession.
He should talk,
she smiles. I've been sparring with Zygmunt Moloch for a lifetime, Kara. Mizard's right. It's become too personal. I can't see past it, so I have to let it go. The repair of Eustace Majoris is an obligation I cannot ignore. Every word they spoke was correct. In fact, I think they were quite diplomatic about it, all things considered. I have a duty to the rank I hold. I bested Moloch soundly and should content myself with that.
For throne's sake, let others waste their days hunting the mad bastard to his doom. Kara shakes her head and sits down on one of the stone benches. Over the years I have come to appreciate how gorgeous she is. Not beautiful like Kiss, but warm and curved and appealing. I have known her physicality from inside, wearing her on so many occasions. She is the closest thing to a lover I can claim anymore, although only in the most tenuous, perverse sense. And now she has another in her life, a man who can provide her the simple human consolations I will never manage. I know she feels this too. She has been far more unwilling to let me wear her lately. I chide myself that I am a fool for feeling cuckolded. I am surprised and, I hate to admit it, delighted by her persistence.
What about closure? She asks.
It's overrated. Kara snorts.
Since when?
Gregor always chased proper closure. And look where he ended up. That's not for me. I have strayed as radically as I am comfortable with. I will not plunge on and become a rogue. I can taste the disappointment in her suddenly, even though I am not touching her mind. She cannot hide it.
What about the rest of us, Gideon? She asks.
What about you?
Did you not consider that we might need closure too? For Majescus? For Nora and Will and Alina? For Zeth?
That's low.
But it's true.
Service is its own reward.
Not actually, she says, getting to her feet. For you, maybe.
I thought you'd be pleased.
Pleased?
We'll be here another week while I get my affairs in order. Then we'll return to Eustace Majoris. Once there, it will be a long and forensic process of evaluation and report. The team will be non-active. It would be a good time for self-review and reorganization, for changes. I thought you would be pleased at the opportunity.
Again, pleased?
I have sensed there is something on your mind, Kara. I think I know what it is.
There's nothing on my mind.
There is.
There's nothing. Get into my head if you want to. Take a look. But stop inferring from my surface moods. There's nothing.
Very well.
I mean it.
I can tell. She stares at me. She seems angry.
Or is it guilty?
I won't probe. I trust you. For a fleeting moment, Kara looks let down. She begins to walk away.
We need closure, she says.
We got it. On Eustace Majoris, we got it. The rest is just housework.
But you had a hunch, she says. Your instinct told you he was here.
Kara, I hate to diminish myself in your eyes, but it's quite possible I have been fooling myself. History makes me want to finish the business with Moloch, and, moreover, I have little appetite for the arduous chores awaiting me on Eustace. This chase has become displacement activity, putting off the inevitable. Yes, I had a hunch. Just a hunch. And sometimes they don't pay out.
Yours always do, she says.
Throne, how those words will come to haunt me. Not this time. Moloch isn't here. My hunch is empty air. It's time we stopped this and got on with something useful. Chapter 4. Naked, Orfeo Kalzean lay face down on a suspensor couch and allowed the Inca to finish composing the final deed across the small of his back. Kalzean found the tiny prickle and pinch of the Inca's needles quite stimulating. The quiet gave him time to think, space to think. The tiny pain kept his thoughts sharp. His mind was a huge, purring engine, always active, and it benefited from reflection. Time to think, to consider, to pace around a problem and survey it, end to end.
In my experience, he said out loud, the Imperium is full of holes, and the trick is to identify those holes and exploit them.
Working tightly with his steel needles, dabbing them occasionally into the inkpots spread out on the floor beside his knees, the Inca grunted acknowledgement. He did not understand Kalzean's words, because Kalzean was speaking Idrish, a Halo Star dialect he'd picked up in his formative years. The Inca assumed his client was murmuring some pain-relieving mantra. People often found the needlework excruciating.
I mean, billions and billions of lives, all herded and ordered by a vast bureaucracy. You find the spaces in that, you see, the gaps. You don't disrupt the system, for that makes you visible. You inhabit the voids within its structure and disappear.
The Inca grunted again. Calzean shook his head. Fools. Idiots. They were all fools and idiots, except Moloch and Ravana. And for the benefit of the former and the beguiling of the latter, he was engaged in this present business. It was a task few men could have risen to. But he was singular, and there would be rewards. My, what rewards there would be. The exclave's perimeter alarm buzzed quietly. Lucius Vorner got up to see to it. The huge, scar-faced bounty hunter, brought into Kulzian's employ by fate and circumstances, had been sitting silently in a dark corner of the room like a stone idol. Kulzian thought Vorner an impressive specimen, though he preferred to work with more subtle, delicate tools. But there were times when the crude muscle and firepower of a beast like Vorner were indispensable. After a minute or so, Vorner reappeared through the door at the end of the long room, followed by Layla Slade and Moloch himself. The candles flickered in the draught.
"Layla! Zygmunt!" Kulzian called, looking up.
"Busy?" she asked, grinning. "Naked busy?"
"You are a tease, Layla Slade," Kulzian chuckled. "The nice man with the needles is almost done."
The exchange had been made in low Gothic, and the Inca understood it.
"I am almost completed," he said.
Layla nodded.
"Making us legal?"
she asked her master in Idrish. Moloch looked on.
"Just so,"
Kulzian replied in the same dialect.
"The deeds to the exclave transferred to my skin. All legal and above board. This work makes us invisible to the system."
Tancred's property laws were obtuse and ancient. Ownership of land, dwellings, estates, and slaves were considered binding only when they were tattooed onto flesh. A man had to have the deeds of his legacy pricked into his skin before the legislature would regard him with any genuine authority. The Guild of Incas was an ancient and trusted office and plied their trade in the merchant quarters. When deeds were transferred, existing tattoos were blacked out. To be blacked was to be disowned or disinherited. Certain ruthless and prosperous landowners entered the legislature wearing the dry, rustling skins of those they had inherited from, like capes. The exclave was a little system of towers and habitats situated on the north end of the central city arm. Kulzian had owned it for 20 years, since a certain deal he'd made, but he'd had the deeds held on the skin of a seneschal, a man in his pay. Now he had returned to claim the site. He'd paid the seneschal off, had the deeds blacked, and was having them rewritten on his own flesh. The seneschal had been remunerated well for his service, and then killed and disposed of by Lucius Vorner. Kulzian was not a man to take chances.
"We're almost done," Kulzian said in Idrish. "Well, hurry up. I have things I want to talk about,"
Moloch replied. He had wandered around the couch and was examining the Inca's needles. He had also spoken in Idrish. Kulzian looked at him.
"My friend, I had no idea you were fluent."
"I'm not, but it's easy enough to pick up."
"From a few sentences?" "Orfeo, I believe you still underestimate me."
"He's a wonder," Layla said brightly. "And he has a trick with a gun, too, that..."
"What?"
"Nothing."
"It's done,"
said the Inca in low Gothic, rising.
"Thank you,"
said Kulzian, gathering up his robes as he stood.
"There is the matter of payment, sir,"
the Inca mentioned, delicately.
"I'll cover it,"
said Moloch in Idrish. He weighed the needle he was holding and then, very simply, flicked it. It impaled the Inca through the right tear duct, sticking out like an unnaturally long eyelash. The Inca wavered. An ink-stained tear track ran down his right cheek. Then he fell, dropping onto his knees initially, then folding at the waist so his upper body crashed face first onto the tiled floor. Layla Slade winced. The face-on impact had driven the needle in up to the stub.
"Coins would have sufficed,"
Kulzean said mildly. Lucius Vorna chuckled a deep, dirty laugh.
I would like to have a proper conversation with you, Orfeo,
Moloch said, taking a seat.
That sounds ominous,
Orfeo replied.
Drink. Seek him,
said Moloch. Orfeo nodded to Layla.
For all of us, he said.
What about? Layla asked, glancing at the Inca's corpse, kneeling as if in prayer.
I don't think he needs anything.
I meant...
I know, Lay. We'll clean up later. Zygmunt here has things on his mind.
Layla brought the cecum in heated drinking kettles. Kulzean sipped and arched his back a little to relieve the pressure on his raw tattoos.
What's on your mind, Zygmunt Moloch?
Moloch smiled. His smile, like his face, was woefully asymmetrical.
Let me begin by saying I am in your debt. There's no question about that. You pulled me out of Petropolis when my plans came apart, and for 6 months you have protected me. I was telling Layla this earlier. I owe you, and I appreciate it. There's no guile here. When I can, I will reward you handsomely.
Kulzean nodded politely.
And the but is... I fear we are about to clash, you and I, said Moloch. I broached this topic in the hope that we can avoid such an eventuality. But we will clash, sooner or later. Your reasoning? By any reasonable scale, I am an abnormal intellect. An alpha. A plus alpha. With due respect, judging from the time we have spent together, I see you are too. Thank you. You are a genius, Orfeo. The Cognitae would have been proud to own you. Again, thank you. Are you trying to get me into bed, Zygmunt?
Layla chuckled. Smiling again, Moloch shook his head.
We are both manipulators, schemers, plotters. We both discern patterns where others see only nonsense. We can create and drive extravagantly complex ploys and see them to fruition. In short, we are, I fear, too much alike for it to be healthy.
Kulzean sipped from his kettle again, and then set it down.
I agree with everything you've said so far. Go on. If we work together, we could do unimaginable things. But we are not together in this. You call the shots. You do not confide in me. To begin with, this was expedient. Now it has become a handicap. There is a real danger we will conflict and tear each other apart. What I'm saying is, we need to be frank with one another. Frank is good.
Moloch rose to his feet.
I'm not playing, Kulzean. Since Petropolis, I have been your cargo, your trophy. I am valuable to you. I imagine you could earn a tidy sum by delivering me to all manner of interested parties. That is something I would not tolerate.
Really?
Asked Kulzean, sitting back, aware that behind him Layla Slade had risen quietly and Lucius Vorna had taken a step closer.
You know, Zygmunt, that sounds ungrateful. I pulled you out of the furnace, but now I'm not useful anymore. That's not what I meant. That's how it sounds. It sounds like it sounds. I believe we could do great works together, but as partners. Not like this.
Kulzean got up and faced Moloch. Slade closed in beside him.
You are alive because I made it so,
Kulzean said.
You have evaded capture and execution because I made sure of your safety. I have watched over you, schemed to protect you, worked hard to... I understand. Ravenna has been behind us every step of the way.
Moloch snarled.
Every step. He has followed us and hunted us and haunted us everywhere we've gone these last 6 months. He... That's the point,
Kulzean said quietly.
What? That's the point.
It was one of the few times Layla Slade had ever heard her master raise his voice.
We're better to hide than in that bastard's shadow,
Kulzean asked softly.
You are the most wanted man in the sector, Zygmunt. Where do we go? In towards the core? Not with your face on every tracking warrant and wanted list. What about out into the halo? No, because there's nothing out there. All we could do is hide. To work our magic, you and me,
We have to stay inside the system. That's what I've been doing. Ghosting Ravenna's every move. Staying in his shade. In his blind spot. Your great enemy is hiding us by his very presence.
Moloch paused, frowning.
It wasn't easy to do, said Kalzean. So show me some damn respect.
Moloch took a step backwards. It was rare for him to be blindsided. He groaned.
Oh, Orfeo, this is precisely why we should be working together, talking to each other. Your strategy with Ravenna is brilliant. I commend it. But you should have told me.
Calm down, Layla said. Just calm down. Don't make me draw on you twice in one day, Moloch. Moloch was too exasperated to be mollified.
Draw away, Layla. You know what happened last time.
Annoyed, Slade pulled her pistol and aimed it at the side of Moloch's head.
Again with this,
Moloch said, making that particular flicking gesture with his right arm. Slade's weapon tumbled up into the air. He caught it. Her left hand was aiming a lasblunt body pistol at him. I learn, she said. Behind her, Lucius Vorner had quietly unshipped his bolt pistol.
Oh, put them away, both of you,
Moloch said sourly. He looked at Kalzean.
We need to start sharing and cooperating right now. Why? Because I fear things have gone wrong. Wrong? Ignorant of your fine scheme and concerned with the situation, I have put plans of my own in motion. I fear they will now conflict with yours, and that conflict may harm us both.
Kalzean sighed.
Thronzig, what have you done?
As if on cue, the exclave's outer gate bell chimed.
Visitor, said Layla.
See to it,
Kalzean replied. Layla holstered her lasblunt and caught her pistol as Moloch threw it. She locked it away and headed out of the room. Kalzean looked at Moloch and repeated,
What have you done? I was looking after myself. Leave that to me. I will, if you will keep me informed and remain open to my ideas. We have to work together or we'll destroy one another. I heartily concur.
Slade returned, trailed by a figure in a long grey stormcloak, the hood up.
A visitor for our guest, she said.
Probably not a great idea to entertain with a corpse on the floor,
Vorner rumbled, glaring at the dead Inca.
I won't stand on ceremony,
said the hooded figure. The newcomer turned and faced Moloch.
This is a matter of the most pleasant fraternal confidence.
Moloch smiled. The ancient cognate code greeting was like a lost, mournful echo to him.
And I stand ready in confidence for a knowing brother,
he replied, as was the form.
Ravenna is quitting this world. His hunt is over,
said the hooded figure.
Good news,
Moloch replied.
There is just the final business to conclude,
said the hooded figure.
Oh, Sigmund, tell me, what the hell have you gone and done?
Kalzean whispered.
I have made a commitment that must now be honored,
Moloch said.
We must make the best of it.
He stared at the hooded figure.
What remains?
The man drew his hood down and shook out his long white hair.
All that remains is the most dreadful amount of killing,
said Interrogator Balak. Chapter 5 They met in the pavilion of a salon in the depths of Bastine. It was a genteel place, the haunt of fashionable society. Dressed in robes, in jeweled gowns, in all their finery, the grandees of Bastine came to the salon and others like it to see and be seen. Carriages and ground cars queued to deposit their passengers under the tented awning where las dancers and contortionists performed in the twitching brazier light. Inside, the place was lit by glow globes and hanging lanterns. Each booth and dining table was screened off in its own tent of white silk, which magnified the lamplight and created a creamy luminosity like vellum. Silhouettes moved across the silk screens. There were the sounds of laughter, of conversation, of clinking glasses, of soft chamber music. The smells were of perfume and obscura, cecum and hot, intense chocolate. Servitors hurried to and fro, bearing laden trays. He took a booth on the right-hand side of the salon, and had ordered Amasek and a pot of mud-thick dark chocolate when she arrived.
"Drink?"
asked Nail. She shook her head. She was wearing a black velvet overgown, as rich and black as the night outside, a matching hat with a lace veil, and a stole of jet-dyed fur. She looked regal, like an empress, like the dowager governor of an ancient core world.
"Sit, then."
She sat on the satin-upholstered couch across from him. Dainty laughter, prompted by some witty remark, pealed like bracelet bells through the white silk wall behind her. She reached her arms up, drew long silver pins out from behind her head, and removed her hat and veil. It was the most sexually charged disrobing he'd ever seen.
"Will your master miss you?" she asked.
"What?"
"Will your master miss you?"
"Oh, no, not tonight. Too much on his plate. You?"
"Thanks, lets us out," Angharad replied.
"Why did you want to meet with me?"
"You knew my aunt. I would hear you speak of her."
Nail sipped at his amasek. It tasted like molten gold. He couldn't take his eyes off her.
"If that's what you want,"
he said. Nail felt vulnerable, and it wasn't just the fact that he'd come unarmed because of the salon's potent weapon scanners. When she'd told him where she wanted to meet, he'd been obliged to dress up. A grey linen coat and trousers, a white shirt of Sathoni cloth. He felt ridiculous. He felt underdressed. He felt not at all like Harlan Nail. He also felt as if he were committing some kind of betrayal, like an illicit affair. He hadn't told anyone where he was going, especially not Ravana, and he wasn't quite sure why.
"So, your aunt," he began.
"Yes?"
"Your aunt. Well, I knew her, but my master knew her better."
"Your master isn't going to talk to me, not openly. I need to know about the blade."
"The blade?"
"Yes, the blade."
"Not your aunt?"
"She died. The clan has come to terms with that, but the blade, Barbarisita, it must be reclaimed."
"Reclaimed?"
Nail asked. "The steels belong to the clan. This is ancient law. Barbarisita must be reclaimed."
"Well, that's tough. My master has it."
"Your master? Ravano?"
"No, my previous master. Eisenhorn."
Nail's voice faltered.
"Where is he?"
"Lost. Long lost. Sorry, but I know the blade. Know it well. It cut me."
An expression that he couldn't read crossed Angharad's face. She rose, holding the train of her overgown, and moved around the low table where the drinks and silver chocolate pot had been placed. She sat down on the couch beside him. She gazed at him. Golden buttons on her high-throated black gown came right up under her chin.
"Where?"
she asked.
"Where? Sorry, what?"
he asked back.
"Where did it cut you?"
"Through the body, years ago. Right through me."
Angharad leaned forward and kissed him. Her lips were wet and slippery. She took him by the hand and dragged him up from the couch.
"Going well so far,"
he murmured. She kissed him again, lips locked. They rocked each other back and forth, knocking into the table with their legs, shivering the glasses. His amasek spilled. Her mouth was inhumanly hot, her tongue rapid like a wet snake.
"Here? Really?"
he mumbled when their kiss finally parted. A smile licked across her mouth like a flame across parchment. She gestured at the white silk walls around them and the flickering silhouettes cast upon them with a casual flip of her black-gloved hand.
"The salon prides itself on privacy and discretion," she said.
"But the walls are thin. Just silk," he began.
"Are you afraid?"
He nodded. Then they both laughed. They kissed again, bumping into the couch and the table.
"Throne,"
he gasped. She pulled off his coat and yanked open his shirt, tearing the seams apart.
Where?
She demanded.
Gut level,
he replied, moving against her. She ripped his shirt down further to expose his torso, slick with sweat.
Where?
There, he whispered, pointing to the thumb-length dark scar on his knotted lower abdomen, just above his hip. She dropped to her knees in front of him.
Oh, well now.